This is the Relics Audio Hour.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Relics Audio Hour. I am your host, Jesse Lauder, and boy, do we have a special one lined up for you today. It's been a little bit since we last dropped in, but I hope your summer has been full of good times, good weather, good music, and that not too many curveballs were thrown your way. So this past weekend, Dayglo Ventures, our parent company, hosted the 6th annual Lock-In Festival. If you've never been to Lock-In, it's a wonderful festival that highlights the diverse taste of our greater scene, with this weekend's lineup featuring classic staples such as Dead & Company, P-Funk, Sheryl Crow, Toots and the Maytals, as well as future torchbearers like Margot Price, Moon Taxi, and a band near and dear to my heart, the Tedeschi Trucks Band. For artists playing the festival, Lock-In is sort of like a family reunion, allowing for musicians and old friends to truly spend some quality time together in beautiful Arrington, Virginia. And usually these reunions turn into amazing collaborations on stage. Two of those friends, who punctuated the weekend for many, were Eric Krasno of Lettuce and Soul Live fame, and Dead & Company's John Mayer. I'm going to briefly pass the mic to Editor-in-Chief Dean Budnick so he can talk a little bit more about Kras and Mayer's history and their relationship with Relics magazine.
Thanks, Jesse. I first met Eric Krasno in late 1997 at the original House of Blues in Cambridge, Mass. I was taping a Grey Boy All-Star show. Eric noticed my microphones, approached me, and handed me the debut cassette just recorded by his band Lettuce, which had formed a couple years earlier after meeting at a Berklee College of Music high school summer program. By this point, Krasno was no longer attending Berklee, although John Mayer was then beginning his own brief stint at the school following a Connecticut adolescence in which he had attended New York City's Wetlands Preserve and other area clubs, doing his own recording of artists such as Charlie Hunter and Medeski Martin and Wood. The two musicians were introduced by current Dave Matthews Band trumpeter Rashawn Ross, who attended Berklee with Mayer and later appeared with Krasno and Soul Live. In 2007, Mayer invited Krasno and Soul Live to open some dates on his Continuum tour. This past weekend, the two musicians crossed paths once again at the Lock-In Festival, where Mayer was on hand with Dead & Company while Krasno was performing with Lettuce. Kras stepped away from that band as a full-time member in 2015 due to commitments with Soul Live and the Eric Krasno Band, but jumps back in on occasion, as he did this past weekend, along with special guests Mayer, Bob Weir, O'Teal Burbridge, Kofi Burbridge, and a few others during an exceptionally satisfying Lettuce tribute to the Jerry Garcia Band. Relics was on hand to report all of this in the official daily newspaper we created for the festival, the Lock-In Times. You can read some of our daily coverage at relics.com. There, you can also find feature stories from Relics magazine on the formation of Dead & Company, as well as multiple pieces on Krasno's longtime work in Lettuce, Soul Live, and the EKB. In one piece, Krasno discusses reconnecting with Mayer in 2016 to discuss guitar tones after Krasno began performing with Phil Lesh. While you're there, why not subscribe as well? Our September issue focuses on the Relics 44, which identifies 44 people, places, and things that inspire us, including a certain mechanical communication device given to Mayer by Tom Hanks. As for this episode of the Relics Audio Hour, moments prior to the interview, on Sunday afternoon, following that late-night Lettuce set, I happened to be chatting with Kras. Then John walked over, greeted Eric, and the two were escorted to a secret, undisclosed location. I'm going to hand the mic back to Jesse, who can set the scene that followed, and tell you more about this new segment that we are affectionately calling Conversations with Kras.
So as Dean just alluded, this episode is going to kick off what we hope is the first of many, of Eric Krasno talking to other musicians about their craft. Conversations with Kras, if you will. This debut segment with John Mayer covers many topics, including songwriting, guitar playing, and of course, the Grateful Dead. The location wasn't too secret. We did it in a Winnebago backstage at Lock-In, so you can faintly hear Tedeschi Trucks' set in the background. But here it is, in all of its glory. John Mayer and Eric Krasno. Enjoy.
I do find that interesting about people, that if the both of us were on a deserted island and, if the both of us had a virus,
yeah,
and there was one antidote, we would probably split the antidote and both die.
Yeah, because you'd feel so guilty.
You know what
it's,
I mean?
It's like, people, otherwise.
I feel like that's the music industry right now.
Yeah.
It's like, everybody just split the pie so thin so that nobody actually eats.
Right.
But then nobody doesn't eat, but then no one eats. It's a very strange division.
Yeah, no, it is strange. It is strange.
I don't know.
Yeah, how do you, well, I guess that's like a good kind of segue. It's like, how do you find music right now? Like, how do you find music? Like, how do you find what to listen to?
It depends what I have in my mind at any given time based on what I'm going to get from music.
Right.
So I just finished, and you must have also given your last thing you sent me musically, like, take trips through, like, the Spotify top 50.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Sometimes under duress, because I want to understand it. I think you and I are both about the same age, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, and we're almost about the point where most people in our situation get phased out. And I'm very curious about not getting phased out.
Right.
That doesn't always mean making what everyone's making, but I think if you can come to an understanding of it, I'm not sure you have to get phased out.
No, it's true. I mean, I get in a lot of conversations / arguments with people that try to write off anything that's current. I have a lot of friends. I mean, I think maybe, you know, especially, you know, in this scene here, there's a lot, like, people aren't always listening to current records. And it's really important to me to always hear what people are getting into.
Yep.
And I'm sure it's the same for you. And, you know, I go to the top 50, and I would say there's one out of every 10 or so that I actually like currently.
They have something. Even if you don't like them as songs, they offer something. It's sort of like a trip to a library for me sometimes.
Yeah.
It's like a research project.
Right.
Because, you know, I mean, I start backwards from, like, people aren't wrong.
Right.
Right? Like, I think I just don't feel like believing that in 1 year there was this changeover where just, like, people I don't identify are being born. I just don't like the idea. So maybe all it is two or three steps away from my understanding, not a completely alien thing, you know? But also, you also have to balance that with some shit doesn't belong to you.
Let me ask you this.
You know what I mean? Like, you have to listen to it and go, this is not for me, so it doesn't require my criticism.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Totally. Yeah. You just got to respect it for what it is. I mean, I'm like that with a lot of, like, current, like, trap and, like, hip hop. It's like, if I get too crazy into it, I can't think about it too hard. I got to just try to. And that's another thing. Sometimes the production is what I listen for.
That's exactly right.
And sometimes
it's the
lyrics and the music. I mean, can you see past really horrible lyrics and just listen to the music and enjoy it?
Yeah, but I don't know. But see,
I guess it's hard. Horrible is the,
well, that so check it out. Like, you have a culture now that subscribes to their artists and doesn't ever leave.
Yeah.
They basically say, I will contort my brain to accept anything you give me. Right. We watch it happen every week. Somebody comes out with something and you watch. It's like, to be a fan now is to give up at some point any critical or editorial sense, for the most part, right? Like, if somebody drops a bomb, I don't see people cover for it when it's a bomb. But you see people in this unspoken agreement, we're going to get our head around whatever you put out.
Right.
Do you know, you know what I mean?
Kanye.
So, well, yeah, that's a whole different. I mean, I went to a club not long ago and I heard, and I was like, oh, this is like, your agreement is, like, you're a Mets fan.
Yeah.
Like, I'm seeing this kind of Mets fan thing where it's like, even if the team isn't all that great.
I mean, I grew up a Knicks fan. It's the hardest fan to be in the world. And it's one of those things where you just, I've always, and I have some musical equivalents, but eventually I'll have to check out.
Yeah. Well, people are like screwed into their artists.
Yeah.
Like completely screwed in.
Right.
And they're sort of saying, you tell me what's cool and I'll go with it.
Right.
And at first I'll think those shoes are stupid. And if I see it another six times, I'll want them. And that's sort of the conversion process that happens with hearing something you don't like.
Right.
And instead of saying, I don't like it,
they
now say, I just don't get it yet.
Right.
And so it's this constant elasticity of the brain going, well, now I like it. I didn't like it when I first heard it, and now I do.
Well, and sometimes, you know, that's why they say, you know, like, radio breaks an artist. A lot of times they just play it enough and people are going to like it kind of no matter what.
Yeah.
You know,
well, that's what we see now is,
yeah,
I love you. I F with you.
Yeah.
And therefore, whatever you give me, I'm going to work as hard as I can to assume that it's right and I'm not, and I'm going to come to it. By the way, I'm not lambasting that. Like, that's just the way things are now, you know? And for me and for you, it's really like people don't unfollow people. People don't give up on people anymore. Like, your guy is your guy for 100 years now. I mean, you can also say it spills over into politics, too. It's like, if you disappoint me, I'll just change my expectations for you.
Right.
And then you're okay again, you know?
Right.
So there's all these new things.
Well, I think some people enjoy the ride to a certain degree. I think that's a lot of that, and that relates to the Grateful Dead in a big way.
Agreed.
I think part of, I mean, it was almost like, and I remember, so I saw the Grateful Dead when I was 12 years old. My brother brought me to a show and he was 18. I had an older brother who would bring me to concerts and all the different things. And he started explaining to me this culture that they would trade the tapes and who saw what show, what songs did they play, and why was this night better? And some nights were better than others. Some night had the set list you liked, but it was this thing where you went every night because you wanted to see, not even, you wanted to see the bad show and the good show. You wanted to like be able to converse about it with all your friends. You wanted to like have both experiences because you can't have this super, super high without some sort of
dip. I say they're like baseball cards. A set list is a pack of baseball cards. And you hope you get the one you need.
Right.
And you go, got it, need it. Yeah. And some nights you say, got it the whole time, you know? And I learned, I think probably on this tour, ultimately, that that's part of what people like about it. And it's not part of what I like about it. It forces me to get off of my pop guy thing.
Yeah.
And the part of being a pop guy is fear. Fear is just innate to being a pop guy. What if they don't like it?
Yeah.
What if this doesn't become a hit?
Yeah.
What if it's this? What if it's that? And so for me, ultimately, like my thing is always, well, I don't know if there's enough bangers on here.
Yeah.
And when we think back to our favorite records, like our favorite Dead live tapes, some of them have no bangers on them, quote unquote. Yeah. And they're great. Like, it's just a real good Mexicali blues.
Well, it's hard to trust your audience sometimes. And this goes back to, and I mean, this works in, I think, both places. It's like, you can trust them, but I don't want to a lot of times. Like, I want there to be bangers all the way through the record.
That's my instinct.
A lot of times, like, you know, the last record I made, the song that everyone comes up to me and likes the most is the slow song at the end that I almost didn't put on the record.
Yeah.
And I was like, I can't put this out there. This is like, I mean, they're going to be so bored. And but, you know, you never know.
Yo, if the fans got to hear everything I did in the studio and pick the record, two things. They would love the record and I would never be able to recognize what it was.
Right.
If they were in the studio and went, no, finish that. We love that.
Right.
I know the track list would be completely different.
Yeah.
I just don't know a better system. There's just not a better system for creating things. I always say there's four rules to writing a song, to looking at a song you're about to write or whether you want to keep working on it. Is it good?
Yeah.
Do I like it? Because those are two separate things.
Right.
Is it me? Because that's three separate things. And do I want to do it live night after night? Or can I? You know, is it replicable?
Right.
And at this point in my career now, it's like, there can be a really good song, but if it's not me, I just refuse to put it out anymore.
Right. What about replicating it? Is that something that do you separate the live show from the record? I mean, obviously you do somewhat, but I mean, do you say, do you just make your tracks and go, I love this, I'm doing this?
I made a record called Battle Studies, and I didn't think about playing them live. I just thought about, like, is this like a neat song? So I didn't ask myself, is it me? Do I like it? I just went, that's one. And I remember being on stage and like starting these songs off and a marked difference in the crowd reaction for those songs versus the older ones. And I went, oh no. And I think ever since that record, I now imagine myself on stage for most of the songs. I think it's okay to have one or two where you'll never play them. And like, I wrote a song the other day, and this is not the first time I've done this, where the main line of the chorus was falsetto, and the part I could really sing was the harmony under the falsetto.
Right.
How do you do that?
You get someone else to sing that part.
So now now you're in already in like a hall of mirrors trying to get that done, you know?
Yeah.
And songwriting is really a full contact blood sport with yourself.
Right.
It's obnoxious how obsessed you have to be to get there.
And
I worked on a song, I thought I had one a week ago. Stopped the presses. Yeah. All I did was work on this song. And then I realized probably don't want to go to Germany and do this. You know, right, you've got to be able to unpack the song in Europe and want to go there in your mind.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I mean, those are hits to me. Hits aren't radio hits. I don't even know. I mean, I have a song on the radio that's a hit. I have no idea where it is, how it's doing. I rely on other people to tell me via email it's doing it. Right. I don't feel it in the world. The world is splintered into a billion different pieces.
Yeah.
What I care about is, do I want to go to Lawrence, Kansas and play that song there?
Right.
And if I want to get there and unpack my suitcase metaphorically and otherwise and go play that song there, then it's a hit song to me.
Right, right.
And like, for that reason, I can't wait to go play New Light, because I want to play that song a million times. If it's only a good song, technically, and isn't a place I want to revisit, I should just start giving them to other people.
Yeah, I mean, that's all, you know, have you done much of that?
No, I'm just starting now to co-write. I never understood it. Now I'm starting to understand co-writing. But no, I've never... My stuff is so unique to my own inability as a singer. Like, I write songs around my voice.
Yeah.
I have to put a lot of tricks into my songs, meaning, like, they're me. Because when I hear someone... Like, for instance, when I hear someone else cover my song, I go, oh, man. It's like the old Henny Youngman line. Oh, no, it wasn't Henny. It was Ronnie Dangerfield. It's like, Eric, I have to, but you... You know, I'm giving punchline first, but walking in on your best friend having sex with your wife.
I have to, but you?
That's, you know, classic. I look at it like that with classic. My music. I'll turn on the TV or something, or I'll see a clip online of like a singing competition show, and I'll go, oh man, I have to, but you? Yeah. You don't have to do this. I have to, because I can't, I don't have the range.
Right, right. Well, I actually was co-writing before, or I mean, essentially, I was writing within bands first and wasn't singing them, and then started writing for other people, and that became a thing I did for a long time. And just in the last few years, started actually singing my songs. So I'm coming from a complete backwards thing.
Wow.
And really, I'm just now figuring out where I can sing and where, and that's changing the whole thing.
You have to write within your range.
I have to write within my range, which I did not know anything about. And I made a whole record not knowing that. So it's all over the place. I'm trying to figure it out. And this, now I'm kind of figuring it out. But, you know, getting to work with Tedeschi Trucks Band, I wrote a lot of songs with them. And then Susan's got this, and she can do anything.
If I were able to write, if I had Susan's voice, the number of songs that I could write would be like a whole other artist. I would be like cloning myself.
But it's super fun. I mean, I think it's like, and also kind of going into someone else's like head. And that's kind of what I do with the new record that I make. It's a concept record. So it's all coming from other people's perspectives and these conversations and whatever. And I think that's interesting. I mean, that's another thing I wanted to ask you is in your writing, are you usually sitting down and figuring out, okay, what do I want to say?
100%.
Like, yeah.
It's getting harder as I get older. Number one, I've said it. And I can say, you're either a type of person who's done it once and went, well, by definition of having done it, I can't do it again.
Right.
Or you go, let's just do more of it. I don't have that.
Right.
If I've done it, then by definition, I can't do it again. So there are fewer and fewer parking spaces that are open for me for ideas, which is fine. It just means I have to work a little harder and I'll put fewer things out every year. But each thing just has to pass the standard. So
right
now, I look at it like, what's my take on the world? Well, How can you be honest right now about a world that isn't honest? How can I sit down and write a song about the way people feel when people can't be honest right now about the way they feel? Because if they were, we would all be fucking crying. I mean, there's such emotional interference in the world. Like, that's part of what this meme culture is, part of... It's all sort of cover up for the fact that you are actually kind of sad. You are actually kind of fatigued. So I don't really know how to unpack it as a writer right now. So yeah, everything I do has to come from the fact that I'm thinking about it in a way that I believe is different than anyone else is thinking about it.
Right, right.
If I were to write a song right now that was honest, it would be like, can we all just cry? Can we all just cry and admit we don't know what we're doing and that we're faking all of it?
Yeah.
And that we all have the right idea. And the competition for your right idea is so strong that it turns to anger before you ever get to express the totality of your good idea. That I see people discouraged about their own hope before they ever get a chance to exhibit it. I just see all of this gridlock, cultural, emotional, spiritual gridlock. And I'm supposed to sit down and just start tapping away on a typewriter and make a chorus out of that.
Wow.
You can't, you know, it's just, it's a it's not the worst, this is not the worst round to sit out.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I hear what you're saying.
I'm not negative about it.
But
I'm
also, okay, let's, I mean, like, let's talk Robert Hunter and Jerry Garcia. I mean, they're most, I mean, so much of that is like taking you into a different time and a different place. And like, has that or even Barlow, like, has that influenced you at all or inspired you at all?
Inspires and influences me, like, out of my mind. I don't know that I can match it or that I want to try and, like, I think there's the difference between loving something and thinking you can do it.
Right. I mean, trying to write a song like China Cat Sunflower or Scarlet Begonias, I mean, like, how would you even
go there? I'm too left-brained. I'm too analytical.
Yeah. And I'll go to those as, like, references, like, oh, well, they're just talking about, you know, trombones and cats. But it's so beautifully put, so well put together.
But it's also grandfathered in based on an era. You know, it's grandfathered in because it's true to the era.
Yeah,
so I call a certain style of writing, I call it Sally from the Alley writing. And I love those songs.
Yeah.
I love those songs. The songs about Sally from the Alley.
Yeah, yeah.
If I let myself put one out,
yeah,
I wouldn't trust my instinct. Like, you would hear me do it and go, Mayor, that's not you. I mean, I have to hear a song back and go, that's who I am.
Yeah, yeah.
And if I wrote this song, like, Sally from the Alley, something's shaking, something, and the hearts are breaking.
I'm using
Sally
that reference now.
Yeah, Sally from
Lettuce,
the Alley.
Because Lettuce needs songs like that. Like, when we write for Lettuce, it has to be funky, and it has to be Nigel singing. So it has to be something, you can't get too, you know, introspective. You can't depress anyone.
This balance,
it's really hard to write songs like
this.
This
nexus that you're talking about is where I live 24/7.
Right.
It's alchemy. It's like making fragrances. You're talking top notes, bottom notes. You're talking about 600 different little essences, and you've got to take a little medicine dropper and build these little tiny fragrances based off of 8 different things. Well, it's not to this, not to that, not to this. That I am obsessed with it. It drives me insane, and because we do have to find these balances.
Right.
You know, you can't just be too, you know, Sally from the Alley and the Cadillac shaking her thing. Come on, baby, bring it back. And baby mama, it cuts me to the bone.
Right.
I don't say cuts me to the bone.
Yeah.
So if I write a song and I'm going, cuts me to the bone.
Yeah.
Just hurl something at me. Because it's not honest.
Right. No,
what's honest right now is like, man, we are all like children trying to entertain each other while our parents are screaming at each other. We're doing the thing that children do to protect themselves from the yelling and the screaming that they hear in the other room. My brothers and I, when that happened, you become besties. You just take care of each other. You try to make each other laugh.
You think that's the silver lining, essentially?
No, I think that's the funny colored umbrella.
I mean, I feel like, I mean, right. I mean, you it's know? Also like things like lock-in and whatever. People are, I feel more than ever, people coming together. I mean, not to sound corny, but where people are understanding that they need to like cherish their times together.
No, 100%. You know, dude, if you lost a wallet here, you'd get it back.
Right.
The stash would be gone. But you'd get everything else back. You'd go, well, I've got my $600 in cash, but my stash is gone.
Right.
But no, if you dropped a wallet at lock-in, you would get it back. Just like I imagine if you dropped the wallet in 1958, you'd get it back.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Let's hope I get those shades back that I lost this morning.
Well, look, I mean, I think about it all the time. Like, why can't you develop your own sense of chronology?
Right.
You know, why can't you make time stand still however you like it? I often think, like, how far away are we from, like, sectors of culture just deciding that they're from the 70s?
Right.
Like, why can't you just be like, those are greasers from the 50s, and it's 2020, and they've just decided to hang out by a payphone?
Well, that's kind of what bands are sometimes. Like,
you're right.
You know what I mean? That's kind of what bands can do. That you're allows us to do that.
You're not just being over, like, that's not just an artistic thing to say. That's 1,000% right. Yeah, bands totally get to say, well, we're from the 70s.
Yeah.
I saw this thing on Instagram today of the Allman Brothers playing.
Yeah.
And I was like, why can't I get a Les Paul and you and I can get together and not be Spinal Tap about it, but kind of go into it?
Yeah.
Like, I just want to live everyone's life. Do you ever feel that way?
Oh,
you ever see someone live a life and you go, why can't I live that life?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think about, a lot about the 50s and that jazz era, and I'm just like, oh man, if I could. And when like Coltrane was like a pop star, you know, and Miles Davis, those were the coolest guys on the planet, and they were supposed to be.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like that era to me, I just wish I could spend, you know, or like the late 60s in San Francisco, which my dad was in the middle of, but I'd love to be there. I mean, there's, you know.
I don't have much. I don't take much information from reality.
Yeah,
and I should as I get older. And I'll see a photo or something from like the 60s, and I'll get so inspired and actually deluded into believing I can do that.
Right.
Like if I just put my mind to it, the short of time travel that I can, instead of me going back to it, I can bring it here.
Yeah.
Because you really can believe whatever you want to believe now. Yeah. There's no more cumulative. Intelligence. You go like, well, I'd like to cherry pick that. What if you and I went on stage and with this band and I played a gold top Les Paul.
Yeah.
And I had the coily guitar cable.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and an embroidered strap. And we went and played these songs that were like Southern rock songs, but new. And we rolled on an old bus that broke down all the time. Like
I think we'd crush it.
I want those experience. You know what I mean? We'd crush it.
Totally. Totally.
I have a hard time as I get older. Accepting that there are certain experiences that I long for that I'll never have. It's getting harder and harder to think that, I'm 40. Like, you're not going to be able to like launch every idea you have. Do you have that? Because you have this Renaissance man thing about you.
Well, I jump around a lot. You know, I think that's my blessing and my curse is like that I get to do so much different stuff. I'm always working on a different record and I'm always like playing with a different band and or running around. And in the last couple of years, I've started focusing more on doing my own thing. I feel like you did your own thing for a long time and now, you know, I guess you always did different things, but and musically different things, but you know, now especially being in Dead & Company and like, you know, I see you playing with a lot of different people.
Yeah, now it's what's the word you would use? It's just sort of unbundled and untethered because everything else is. I mean, it wouldn't have worked 15 years ago, but I'm hoping that in my life I can sort of biorhythmically match whatever the world is supposed to get from me, you know, I just know that my first order of business is that if I was on a deserted island and all the pieces to make a radio to get me off the island were there, I could build the radio.
Yeah, I hear you.
And I don't know how long it would take, but I always want to have faith in myself that the world will never change so quickly as to completely eradicate me, that all it takes is some rethinking and some stepping back and divorcing yourself from ego for a minute and go, okay, let's throw out everything we've ever done and just look at this like a musician.
Right, right.
You get to look at it every year like a musician. I know that I've had some pop success and I think a lot of people focus on that. I don't know if it's too much or not, but like we're musicians. So we always get to look at whatever's going on in the weather report and respond to it in some way that agrees with it.
Right.
You know, you sent me a record that's you making a really competitively produced album of songs that sound like other songs. Not in their composition, but it's just in the texture of it.
Right.
You know, and that's you going, I think I know how to survive no matter what. Right?
In certain ways, it was kind of like a challenge. Can I make a record like in this space and make it sound coherent, kind of without a band? And I kind of said that before. And, you know, it was, but yeah, that is part of it. Can I just play everything and write everything and try to do that? And it's, for me, it's like you said, you kind of see these different, you know, I guess kind of outlets, but also just like earmarks of like, I've always wanted to do that. You know, for me, it was like, I never sat down and played acoustic guitar and sang my songs. I was scared shitless of doing that, and I'm just like making myself do that's also like a 40 thing. It's kind of like, I never did that, let me try this,
right?
Let me
right.
try that. And I think that's also the cool thing, and it goes back to like, no one's unfollowing, and I think that's also this scene a little bit is able to embrace me for doing whatever. We'll play instrumental Lettuce for an hour and a half, and then I'll go sit in the VIP tent and play like acoustic songs for an hour.
They like,
and the people
your
are coming to both, you know.
Yeah, they like you.
I guess I was afraid of that for a long time. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I can't just go there and sing these songs. They're not going to be into that. But really, you know, they're really supportive. I think that's something that started in the in the kind of Grateful Dead scene and has now kind of permeated all these different things.
You could say, like, culturally, we're like just having a moment. We're like having an affair with inauthenticity for a minute.
Right.
Everybody is having a fling with being inauthentic.
But I think by doing these things, it's also like letting me know. It's like, okay, this really works. And that's maybe this doesn't.
And you're allowed to go off and come back and go, oh, no, this, I had it right the first time.
Right.
I mean, that's life. Life is getting it right.
Yeah.
Leaving that completely behind.
Oh, yeah.
Getting smacked and going, I had it right the first time.
I think
time.
Part of that, like realizing it and kind of getting to a good place.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if it's always cut and dry. I mean, with Soul Live, we did instrumental records for years. Then we decided we're going to like go into this realm and do this. And I don't know if that was the best idea, but we kind of had to do it.
Yeah, that's right.
Because then we came back, and now it's kind of somewhere in between.
And by the way, you know what I mean? At its worst, what do you lose? Nothing. Yeah. You made a record that's a little like this, and maybe you only play three songs off of it.
Right, right.
You know, there's no record I won't play a song off of.
Right, right.
So we're talking about, like, some sort of artistic immortality. Like, you'll respawn.
Right.
If you make a record that you thought was great and turns out it isn't, it's like getting shot in Call of Duty.
Right,
you just respawn.
Right.
And you're like, oh, I got to do another one.
Right.
So why would you not take chances? I mean,
But I guess in the moment when you're, like, going to put something out, like, sometimes there's a freak out moment.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's like, you don't, I mean, you don't see the 2 years down the line. You see, like, I'm going to put this out and people might hate it and holy shit.
Yeah, but you know how I see it? The actual process of making the record will be the vetting process of whether it's good or not.
Right.
If you like something enough to listen to it, the number of times one must listen to something to write, record, edit, mix, and master. If you don't hate it by the time you're mastering it's a good song. And other people are going to love it because they'll never hear it as many times as you hear it.
Right.
So
right.
you're basically pressure testing it for them. Like when I was mixing New Light,
yeah.
I was still jamming out to it.
Right.
I'm many hundreds of listens in.
Right.
So it's sort of like I'm doing the drop test on it.
Right.
And I'm like, no, it's not going to break because I've heard it more than you ever will.
Yeah, yeah.
So I find that the process is the testing for it. And if I give up, like I give up on that song before I realize like there is, you ever write a song and you're like, what's that first verse? And the answer is there is no first verse.
Right, right.
The answer is there is no first verse because it's not a good enough song to finish. And everyone else looks at it like when you throw a shirt away. You ever throw a shirt away in front of somebody? And they go, you can't throw a shirt away. I'm here to tell you, you can.
Yeah.
But you can also throw away a song and they go, you can't throw that song away. And you go,
well, that's one of the hardest things as a producer that I've, it's like, you know, when you get together with bands and artists, they get really attached to certain song, you know, and that's sometimes the hardest thing for me.
I can't imagine being
like,
in a band.
And it's like, well, producing bands is maybe the hardest job I've ever had because dealing with all of their crazy shit.
Yeah. You have to work inside of the maximum ability of the band, right?
It's more being a psychologist than anything else. But then, amongst that, some of the hardest things I've ever had to do is like, you know what? This song is just not, you know, that's a tough conversation.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
This is a fun one because it's sort of devilish.
Yeah.
You get to steal any Grateful Dead song you want, remove it from history. No one ever knows it exists, but you get to re-record it, and it's an Eric Krasno song. Which one do you steal? Now, remember this in the sort of quantum leap of it all. They don't know they're missing it, so you're not technically – there's no emotional loss of having stolen it from them.
I think that changes week to week
or
month to month. Brown Eyed Women has just got this thing.
How Brown Eyed Women is just not a hit song. How Brown Eyed Women was not a classic rock radio hit is beyond me. It's as good as any Stone song.
It's so good.
How it's not.
And it brings you to a place. So that's something that with the Grateful Dead music in general, but particularly that song, is it brings me somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, so that no other song brings me to that same place.
Yep.
So I think that's there's something about that.
I always thought that like if you stitch all of the Grateful Dead songs together, you get a town that's about, I don't know. You get about 20 square miles, you know, and the people know each other and there's overlap. And I also think it's sort of like Cuba where like there's still old cars, like nothing's new in Grateful Dead land.
New.
Like
no one
in Grateful Dead lyric land ever has a new car.
Yeah.
Everyone's car is old.
Yeah.
The bottles are old and dusty.
Yeah, exactly.
It's Cuba in there.
Yeah,
and I think that's why we like going back in there.
Yeah.
And also
there's a lot of kids with different parents.
Yeah, there's a lot of gambling. A lot of people are
you know, there's like there's you got someone in, you know, Chino and
yeah, but there's also you just get the sense there's not that many women. It's really the same person doing this to each.
It's a little bit like the shows. Actually, maybe not so much recently.
But it's wild though. It's like
shows, a lot of guys.
We you and I could sit and lace together all these songs and come up with a world, a universe of these things. You know, no one's ever home. No one ever gets up in their living room inside of these songs.
Yeah.
They might be trying to get home.
Yeah.
But no one's home in a Grateful Dead song.
That's true.
Everybody's trying to get home.
Yeah. Yeah.
And everybody's broke. And everybody's car is breaking down. Yeah. You get the sense that to be alive inside of a Grateful Dead song is to be sort of a sailor at sea, making the best of a stormy night.
Was there like a song or a situation that you remember that drew you into their music?
There's about 30 of them.
Yeah.
And most
was
of
it
those
like a series of events where you're like, I need to go deeper, I need to go deeper, I need to go deeper.
I can tell you what intersection I was at when these moments happened, which proves that they're very instant sort of epiphanies.
Right.
Where I was when I understood the chorus to Eyes of the World. I was at Ocean and San Vicente.
Yeah.
Where I was when I understood the bridge to Estimated Profit. I was in, I was coming out of a gas station in Palm Springs. And where was I when I first understood that Playing of the Band had the part that went and where I mean, there I listened to 5577 on the way from the Village Recorder in West LA to, you know, Beverly Hills or whatever, and the sun was going down, and I heard the transition between Scarlet and Fire. And I went, this is the greatest thing I ever heard in my life. How I didn't hear this in high school with my love of Jimi Hendrix is beyond me. So there's dozens and dozens and dozens of moments I heard stuff, and Shine a Doll in a hot tub in Palms, a different time in Palms. No, maybe it was the same weekend now I think about it. But all these moments, you like, I heard Gamora for the first time three days ago. And that riff, we talked about that.
Yeah.
Oh man,
it's ridiculous.
Dun dun, boom boom boom. We all have that vocabulary.
But he nailed that. He was amazing at that. And I think a lot of people don't realize. And this is like, I think when I was younger, I found the Grateful Dead before I played guitar. Mm-hmm. And then as I became into guitar, I did Hendrix, Stevie Ray. I went down that rabbit hole. Then I got really into, like, you know, jazz and all that stuff, and didn't realize till I kind of made this full circle how complex the Grateful Dead music is. Because I kind of, when I started playing, and also a lot of the guys I was hanging around with, that just wasn't their thing.
We all said that,
you know,
and
it was like, oh, they're not. It's not a player's
or the
thing.
Or the people who were into it, we didn't identify with, which is the main thing, especially. Did you spend time on the East Coast?
I'm from Connecticut.
You're from Connecticut,
down the road from you.
I think we were children of that sort of touch of gray generation,
right?
And looked at it and went, I don't really relate to these people, so I must not relate to the music, you know?
And and then also I just felt like, I don't know, just I wanted Hendrix was badass, you know. It was like I wanted to be. That was like part of the thing with guitar was like wanted to be like. You know,
that's Michael Jordan.
It was an outlet to just be like, you know.
Oh man, I had the costume jewelry.
Yeah.
I had the crazy necklaces and I mean, we didn't have concho belts, but I found anything close to it. You know?
I built like a Hendrix shrine.
Oh god. By the way, I moved into my house.
This is
and
crazy.
I have all these pictures I bought over the years, but never hung them. You know, and they're in storage, and I take them out, and I'm like, these are all just Hendrix photos.
They're just dozens
of Hendrix photos. You know.
Did you kind of have a did you have a moment that you can remember where you, A, just were like, I want to play guitar, or even like, this is what I want to do? You know, like...
Oh, I was done when I first touched a guitar.
Right. What brought you to that?
Friends always had guitars with, like, they weren't tuned and they didn't have all their strings.
Yeah.
Did you ever have a friend, like, was the first guitar you ever touched that didn't have all...
I had the same guy you're probably talking to. My best friend when growing up had the guitar with, like, you know, missing a couple strings.
Four strings and not... This was a Washburn or something. And you just would tune it to a chord, you know, and just go up and down. It was the sexiest thing. It still is. I mean, it is the most mystifying, beautiful thing in the world to me. You know, I mean, I played 6.5 hours of music yesterday.
Yeah.
I can't do 6.5 hours of anything. But I can somehow have 6.5 hours of playing music and look up and go, is it 3 a.m? Because I thought my watch was wrong.
I
honestly thought I was on West Coast time when I looked at my watch.
That did kind of fly by. It was crazy.
What a place we go to. Yeah. I mean, there is a whole separate version of you that no other human being will ever interact with, that only your guitar knows.
Right, right.
There's giant partitions on your hard drive that no human being will ever identify. When you're playing in G, and you just know that right up here is the thing that goes da-ba-ba, and you know that right below it to the left goes da-da-da.
Yeah, yeah.
No human being will ever interact with you on that level.
Right,
but
right,
when you pick up a guitar, it's like, you ever have a friend who has another friend that you don't know, but they know so well it makes you jealous?
Yeah.
That's sort of what playing the guitar is like. It's like, it's just tough to be around you, Eric, because I don't know you in college, and your college buddies know you by a different nickname.
Right.
My guitar knows me by all different names than anyone else in the world. I mean, like... Yeah.
That's always tough when it, when you have a woman in your life.
Yeah.
I won't go there.
I'm
you know, they look at the guitar, they're like, really? You're always going to go to that before?
Well, I was always astounded at how little it matters how good you are at the guitar.
Right.
In a relationship.
Right. This is true.
How little it matters. Yeah. And I just, if you really investigate this, you're upset either way, right? Because if you're playing the guitar and your girlfriend doesn't like lean in and go, that's good. What is that?
Yeah.
You're a little butthurt.
Yeah.
But if they do, you're like, give me my space.
Right. That's hilarious.
You can't win. You couldn't win. If someone came in and went like, that's bluesy, you'd go like, shut up. You don't know what bluesy is.
Yeah, right.
But if they don't, then it just feels like, I guess I'm just your delinquent son playing my guitar that you don't understand.
Oh man.
You know? But once I started listening to Jerry enough, and this is not an over-rationalization, he's coming from the same place Jimmy was coming from.
Right.
Coming from the same place. So I would love at some point in our life to really investigate and or set straight the irony of people who loved Jimi Hendrix saying, Jerry's not for me because I'm a Hendrix guy. Like, I'm a blues guy. I'm not a... Yo, I hear Jerry do stuff and I go, that is... Jimmy's exact little rainbow road that he was running on. They were running on the same road.
Totally.
They were. Did you ever hear Jerry play certain kinds of riffs and wonder what records he'd listen to in that year that made him play those riffs? Because you'll look at the year and go, oh, he got a Cream record.
Right, right. Oh, there is some of that, actually.
I hear Jerry playing some Eric Clapton stuff sometimes.
Totally.
And I go, I look down and it's like 69 Fillmore and I go, oh, he had a Cream record.
Yeah, he was listening to that record right then.
You know? It's funny, I was talking to Clapton one time and I forgot that he was Eric Clapton. And I said, did you ever get into the Dead? Did you ever get in the Dead, Eric? And he said, well, no, we were always in San Francisco thing and we were in Europe. And I was like, oh, right. You were in Cream at the same time as the Grateful Dead. You can forget like the person you're talking to is like, oh, you were there. Right. You were right. And, you know, forgetting that the guy you're talking to was boots on the ground
right
there. It was like, well, no, because the Cream was sort of doing, you know, like when someone says the Cream, you're like, oh, that's legit. You're like, that's legit. But what we learn as we get older is that all this stuff is fairly well connected, you know?
Totally.
Do you have favorite songs for one reason, or favorite performances of songs that you thought the guitar was particularly otherworldly that night? Are there things that...
Dude, I mean, you know, just this last week, digging into that Jerry band live, it's from like 91, which has the Tangle Up in Blue on that. He goes to a whole other stratosphere that I'd never really realized was there. And it's like, and it was funny because people always are like, you know, say that Trey and Jerry, and I get that. But here I feel like he goes someplace that kind of sounded like where Fish goes.
Oh, that's interesting.
But he's just blazing. I've never heard the energy on that live recording. It's just unreal. He's going for it for a solid 8 minutes.
And that's the Hendrix
just
thing.
Going.
Is being able to forget about what you just played and work in the moment and course through it and not become self-critical. And I think part of the genius of Jerry Garcia was that all guitar players have little segments we work with, and, you know, little riffs, licks. You hear these phrases like licks and riffs, and we work in these building blocks. Some people's building blocks are like just scales.
Yeah.
You know, at the very bottom, if you want to make a hierarchy, you go at the bottom is scales.
Yeah.
And as you keep moving up to the higher degrees of guitar playing, they get a little smaller. They become little phrases. right? So you start with scales if you're just, then you get to licks. Yeah. Then you get to phrases, which is like your own version of licks, like right. taking licks and making them work for you. And then maybe one more level if you're like the best around is you're taking those things and completely inverting those licks to make them a little new. Jerry Garcia was down to molecules right, of right. playing. So he wasn't playing licks.
Right.
He's playing with the smallest building block a person can put together. So everything you're always hearing is original and off the top of someone's head and represents some sort of spiritual whereabouts that one day. So the man's working in particles. You and I are working in Legos.
Right.
Some people work in bricks.
Some
people work in entire prefabricated homes. Yeah. We're probably Legos, right?
Yeah,
so we can
make.
And then he was working in molecules.
Right.
He was. Like, today I'll make a tree.
And I feel like on top of that, and it goes back to not realizing how complex the music can be, mm-hmm. he played over these song forms and these chord changes. Maybe they're not the most complex in the world, but they exist, and sometimes they are complex, in a way that you didn't even know they were there.
Yep.
You know, and there's this fluidity and you know, doing whatever you want to say, chromatic stuff or whatever, but you never knew, it didn't like sound jazzy per se, but it didn't always, you know, it's just the most unique playing yeah. that I've come across.
You want to hear some breakdowns of Jerry's playing that I came up with over the years? He has his completely own dynamic, so he's not really playing the guitar with the ferocity of guitar players,
right?
Which means you can hear it forever, because he's not playing with that sort of hormonal ferocity
right.
that most guitar players have. He's playing on a certain pitch bendiness that all guitar players have their different sort of intonation. His intonation is so beautiful, the way he shakes a note, the way he bends up to a note. Something about it is like little bird bones.
Right.
Little cute, beautiful feathers and bird bones, where a lot of guitar players are like, no, I'm a B-52.
Right.
I'm a stealth bomber. And he was working in these little, like the veins on a leaf.
Right.
You know, these really beautiful, tendrily sort of things. And the other thing is his unbelievable ability to have worked inside of the major scale. So he was, you know, most guitar teachers tell you, like, if you play the minor blues and move it, it's the country blues.
Right.
But he wasn't doing country blues. He was doing blues, but taking out a lot of the blue notes as we know them. So it was this thing that wasn't, you know, in a way it wasn't, and we use the parlance of the era of saying it was white music or black music, you know, to say that's what people were talking about, is it was rhythm and blues or it was country. And he kind of straddled it musically in the middle, where if you really start breaking it down, like, he's playing minor and major at the same time. That allows you to play forever, because your ear never goes like, oh, this is too bluesy, or oh, this is too campy, right? So if you solo in a major pentatonic, it becomes a little da-da-dum-da-da-dum-dum-da. It's like skipping through the woods. If you play in the minor pentatonic for too long, you're like, okay, we have been to you and you're down and you're wailing and we got it. He straddled all of these things that no one guitar player will. You and I should both go and do. It would take you and me and six other guitar players to even come close to equaling one performance of Jerry Garcia's in a live
concert. And he also, you know, actually digging into the Grateful Dead music, I used to always kind of stay away from playing in major scales. You know, it was like always kind of like, I mean, you have to, but in songwriting, it was like, it's also the bands that I was in. We would always want to play these grooves that were, and we'd get to the major part. I'd be like, I'd rather play over the minor section.
Yeah.
You know, but it's from kind of absorbing as much as I can of his playing.
We both kind of shunned major scale stuff.
Yeah.
Now I'm bringing it back.
Oh, I'm totally bringing
it back. B.B. King was playing major scale stuff.
He was.
B.B. King was going, wait, we all heard it as, do-da-da-ba-do-do-do, and he was going, bo-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Exactly.
I mean, this is the trip we take as guitar players, is we look at the same photos differently. You know, you talk about like people who go back, like cops and detectives who go back to the original photos and go, why didn't I see that before? It was right there, that license plate back there. And that's what we do, is we go back over the same music, but with a better brain for it. And that's why we just keep listening and breaking down all these things. And I don't think you'll ever really break down the genetic code of how to make a Jerry Garcia. You can kind of do it with Hendrix, you know? Like if you gave yourself
more,
6 months, you could sound. I mean, like you could fool a lot of people. I've been doing this for 3-4 years now.
Yeah.
But going on 4 years, I can't come close. I mean, I might get a couple seconds where my playing turns to the light in a way that cheats for a couple of seconds. Yeah. I might make you have to look down at the Sirius display for a second to go, wait, is this? Oh, of course, it's dead. Yeah. You know?
Well, that's so. How did you approach A, like learning all the material?
Yeah.
And B, inserting like your thing into it, you know? I mean, and how did you come into it with that thought in mind?
Yes.
Like,
so number one, this is actually an interesting way to like lay out the recipe.
Yeah.
Number one, I didn't know what to be afraid of, so I didn't concern myself.
Right.
But had I seen Long Strange Trip before any of that stuff, I would have been shit scared.
Yeah.
So I knew that I didn't know what was scary, so I didn't look into it.
Right.
That was my advantage. I knew that I had already endured a certain kind of trial by fire in the press and in court of public opinion. And I knew that I had survived, right? So I knew that I wasn't going to get taken out by any one faction, right?
Right.
And then the other thing was I trusted that I learned those songs at the same time I was falling in love with them. So look, when you're 12 songs into loving that band, you know you're another 100 songs to go you're going to love. It gets to a preponderance of evidence. You're like, I'm going to love all these.
Yeah,
so as I was loving a song, I would learn it. You know,
right,
I remember where I was when I heard Dark Star, and it was the original one that started da-da-dip, da-da-dip, da-dip, you know, the single version.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was the first time I understood the form of the song and went home and went, I get Dark Star now.
Right.
You've done. It's like the Matrix. Yeah. You go, whoa, I know Kung Fu. So I was already, whether or not Dead & Company was in the future for me, I was just going to do that anyway.
Right, right.
So it wasn't like I was sitting around and I decided that that would be neat to do with my time. I was already going to go on this path.
Right, right.
I just, in a really interesting way, just brought the scholarship of guitar playing along with me. So as I got to know them, like there was always a level of like this. I'd hear a song and I wouldn't force myself to learn it. I would just listen to it for a while. And then I would pick up the guitar and I would just touch what key it was in. You know, you ever done this where you're trying to learn a song, you got a couple days?
Yeah.
You don't sit and cram. Listen to it for a while so you understand where it moves, you can anticipate. Then you pick up the guitar and I go, oh, it's an A. And if you know the key, you're going to, oh, that must be A to D because you put all the sort of chord numbers in it. And then from there, I would just spar with these songs, just spar and spar and spar and spar.
Playing two recordings.
Playing two recordings.
Yeah, yeah.
You've done this, you know, you spar.
Of course.
And sometimes if you want to, you can try to ignore the guitar player.
Right,
you ever done this when you were young, growing up? You just, the cockiest thing of all time, but you have to. It's like ignore B.B. King and play over him.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to pretend there's no B.B. King on this record.
Yeah,
and you learn this sort of center cancel in your own brain, like phase cancel the lead guitar.
Right.
And I remember doing rehearsals with the band and bringing the recordings back. And I keep mentioning that I have a driver. I have a guy who drives me in LA, and he and I just sort of took this trip together through my learning the songs.
Yeah.
And I would come home and like, I would play him the stuff in the car and I would yell at myself and I would go, nope, see Tim, this sucks.
Yeah.
This sucks. And I remember the first time I played like 5 seconds that I bought.
Yeah.
Like my ears, here's what people need to understand. My ears are better than my hands.
Right,
do you feel this way about you?
Right. Oh, I feel like most of us are like that.
My ears are better than my hand. My ears are 10 times better than my hands. So I know when I overplay. I know as I'm playing that it's not working.
Right.
Do you ever yell at yourself while you're playing?
Oh my God. I was yelling at myself last night.
Yeah, you have like a you have a tennis coach on the side.
Yeah,
and my tennis coach goes like, "Really? You're going that way? You played it. Did that?" I mean, that's why you have to wonder whether drugs played a part in being able to distance yourself from that voice.
Right, right.
Oh, that's clever.
Yeah.
Oh, that?
Right.
You're going to hit him with that old chestnut?
I'm going to do that.
Albert King them again? Now it's time for a little more.
I actually heard like a little clip from last night. I was like, really? Again? I did that
again? With that? Again with that? But there would
sometimes, be. Sometimes you play something and you're like, oh man, that was really cool. Did anyone hear that? I got to do that one more time to make sure they heard that.
Oh, listen.
So then no one hears it and you're like, if anyone hears back.
Then you listen back to it. And you remember that you're about. Okay, so you ever cringe because you remember the moment before it actually plays?
That happened.
You're like,
today,
oh, this is the time I did this 12 more times. Dude, that's what I call practicing on stage. You play a lick that you almost landed, and you're like, you just start taking stage time to just basically try and nail a skateboard trick. It's the guitar equivalent of a skateboard trick.
That is hilarious.
And then you listen back to it and you're like, oh no,
why did
I remember
that?
I'm just about to do this. So the other one for me that happens all the time, which teaches me to slow down in this band, is I'll listen to, and I remember, you know, you remember a song, as soon as it plays, you're like, you kind of know everything you ever played when you listen back to it. And I'll hear this moment and it'll be so good, but I'll remember the experience and I'll know that I leave it in like 5 seconds and go to some and overplaying and I almost yell like, don't go, you're going to fail. And then no, it was working.
It was working. Well, that's something else. Have you ever gone back to a recording of yourself and said, I played too little? I've never
in my life
ever said I've played too much.
Here's where I might have. If I would have played a blues or something and just nothing ventured, nothing gained, and just kind of licked my way through it, maybe, but not in terms of notes played.
Right.
At my most boring to myself, I think it's the greatest. I mean, we did.
But in the moment, you feel like it's not enough, or that's my issue. I feel like I get better with age to just like say, fuck it, and so, I'm gonna leave 4 bars and just then play something else.
So you're trying to get Car Krasno,
to
catch up with Guitar Krasno. So Car Krasno is listening to stuff and he's happy when things just chill. Yeah, man, that playing little goes a long way. That's just enough. Guitar Krasno on stage is going, no, I'm judging everything I play based on the scholastic content of the thing.
Right.
So it's always got to be scholastically sound.
Yeah.
And Car Krasno listens back to that and goes, you idiot.
Exactly.
You idiot. Dude, we did
But I think they're the only one thing that I try to factor in to give alleviate some of my hatred for myself is that I'm thinking, okay, well, it was the energy of
That's
the moment.
Correct.
And it was energy of the people there.
That's correct.
We had to kind of we had to pull it up, you know.
But all that leads to a real admiration and almost astonishment at how the Grateful Dead was able to satisfy both the vibe of the crowd and make the most listenable live recordings since Bill Evans.
Yes.
You know, Bill Evans, any live recording he ever did is worth cherishing.
Yes.
Any live performance the Grateful Dead ever did for like 99.9% is worth cherishing. So how did they service the crowd and service Car John, who sits there and goes, man, I don't know what was going on in 1974. I don't know what the politics were of that moment, but man, this stuff works in 2000, whatever.
Yeah.
And and you're right, because we go, especially with Dead & Company, I go, well, it's a little aggro, but in that moment, everybody was losing their minds. So what an incredible band to have been able to do both and make recorded music.
Right.
Not just documents of the moment, but like it was a live recording studio on stage.
Right.
You know? And by the way, we've talked for like an hour.
We have talked.
And haven't even.
I have to play in like play. 5 minutes.
And haven't even come close to figuring this shit out.
Well, that's the thing.
That was like a great idea.
I wish we could. I wish we could keep going. But
no, let's go. This is beautiful. You're going to have to break this up into like 9 parts. All of this is.
Just
important.
As I thought the conversation was over, I asked Mayer if earlier when discussing the Grateful Dead, he meant the 5877 Scarlet Fire, when indeed he meant the 5577 version from New Haven. This led to several more minutes of some choice rap about Stevie Ray Vaughan and their mortality as players.
5577 is the New Haven Scarlet Fire, which I think is more exciting to me than 5-8, which we all know is Cornell. 5-5 is New Haven. And
I had both. I had both recordings. But 5877 was... That was actually the one that like drew me into like collecting tapes, which I think it's the same for a lot of them.
Well, 5-5 for me... The transition is the most identifiable to me based on my life as being Hendrix-y, watery, brilliantly recorded. You and I are products of the 80s, so we like fidelity, sonic fidelity.
Right.
I don't want to hear Wax Cylinders.
I
love Big Bill Brunzi, but I don't want to hear, you know, not that it's Wax Cylinder, but it's post-Wax Cylinder, but like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I love Lightning Hopkins, but I'm not putting it on the treadmill.
Right.
And so...
That's a good one.
We like a certain fidelity to deliver what the music is, and the Spring 77 tapes with the Betty Board tapes I think bring a lot of modern fans
I didn't even
into
really
the music
think about it like
well
that.
Stevie Ray Vaughan was that for me. That was a lot of Texas blues brought through the MTV Sonic filter.
Live at the El Macambo.
Oh, yeah.
Went nuts over that.
I went nuts.
I wore that. I had a VHS copy and I wore it all the way out.
It's perfect beginning to end.
It's unreal. I remember playing in there and like, I mean, we got there and it was like this crappy club and I was like, oh, this is the greatest gig ever.
It
We're
must have been.
Crush it.
How many times like, do you think you watched that?
Hundreds.
I watched it hundreds of
my
times.
My uncle, who was actually an agent, and he knew. You might know Ron Kaplan, but he was an agent. I don't know if he was actually Stevie Ray's agent, but he hung with all the blues guys. Anyway, he somehow got a tape of that. I don't know if it was already out and distributed. Anyway, he sent me a tape of that when he knew I had just started playing and I had like this crappy copy Strat, and he sent me that, and I literally just stared in front of that thing with my.
All the way. I mean, every last move, you memorized it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know what the analog is for. I mean, it was like studying game tapes, like watching Jordan games or Tyson fights or something. It was just perfect.
Well, that's the thing about that recording, too, and just him in general, was his stamina. I mean, even just to play like eight bars of a Stevie Ray Vaughan solo would probably wear me out for like an hour.
It's one of those genetic things where your music follows your genetics.
Yeah.
And for me, the Stevie Ray Vaughan thing, the timing is impeccable. Impeccable timing, and he will always land the lick on the one.
Always.
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 He taught me, never just play the lick and let it run over the bar line.
Yeah.
That's the number one thing to guitar players. Right, I want to tell all guitar players.
Right. You know? And that was the difference. I mean, a lot of people are like Hendrix, Stevie Ray Vaughan. I mean, Stevie Ray Vaughan just had a precision that was
I don't even know who the boxer is. I wish I knew boxing analogies. I could tell you who he fought But so sharp.
Yeah.
And so intense. And I think fulfilled a certain desire we had as kids for things to be like adrenalized.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm looking at my life now as a post 40-year-old and I'm going, where are the examples of people who play with that fire past a certain age? And then I went, a lot of those guys are gone before 40. A lot of the guitar players who were responsible for setting into motion this high energy style of guitar playing, we don't have points of reference for how to play in our 40s like that because they didn't make
it. That's crazy.
Which is super sad. But we don't know how Stevie would have played at his age now.
I wonder if he would have slowed down.
I don't know. We don't know how to look up to heroes past 40. We don't really have many guitar heroes past that. You know,
it's kind of crazy.
So I was playing with the trio on this last tour going, I don't know how to judge myself based on the slight muscle fat loss in your hands. Do you ever feel it?
Right. I feel it a little bit.
A little bit, right?
A little bit.
Top of your hand, just a little bit.
Oh, yeah, I get a little bit. Yeah. I get it on this side, too.
So I go, I don't know how to compare it to another fire brand guitar player in their 40s. I can't wait for someone to hear that and go like, shut up, man, Paul Gilbert. I'll be like, I know. Yeah, I just can't think of any right now that are in my direct wheelhouse.
Right.
This was a friggin' awesome conversation.
I know.
Somewhere inside, you and I just want to keep going until it's
done. I know. Let's just keep going.
The nihilist in us wants to keep going.
There you have it. John Mayer and Eric Krasno. That was pretty darn special. You've been listening to the Relics Audio Hour. I am your host, Jesse Lauder. You can learn more about me on my website, JesseLauter.com. And if you enjoyed what you heard, there is going to be plenty more from where that came from. So be sure to subscribe to the Relics Audio Hour on the podcast platform of your choice. The Relics Audio Hour is a part of the Osiris Podcast Network. To learn more about Osiris and their many amazing podcasts about music, be sure to visit OsirisPod.com. And I have many people to thank for making this episode possible. First, big thanks to Eric Krasno, Brad Tucker, Brandon Phelps, Bernie Cahill, Christina Tanner, Ken Healy, Josh Timmermans for our cover photo, Mary Beth Ongier, and Gopher Dindis Productions. And I'd also like to thank Officer Huffman of the Virginia State Police for my speeding ticket that I received on my way to Lockin. Thanks for doing your job, Officer. Our theme music was composed by Marco Benevento. You also heard a little bit from Joshua and the Holy Rollers' forthcoming EP, a great new band from Los Angeles. Be sure to check them out. You're currently listening to Cats Under the Stars from Lettuce's Jerry Garcia Band tribute from Lockin, which feature John Mayer and Bob Weir. Many thanks again for tuning in, guys, and look forward to having you back next time on the Relics Audio Hour.